Welcome to Learning Ludic, seriously fun classrooms. My name is Sean Cameron. I'm a media producer and communication specialist at Assiniboine College in Brandon. The following is a product for the Teaching for Learning certification. My guests today are Rich Little, a business instructor at Assiniboine College. Rich has been an educator at Assiniboine for close to two decades. After a successful career in business, Rich joined the faculty at the college. And as a relatively new adopter of Ludic pedagogy, but not a new instructor, gleaning from Rich's adoption of the pedagogy will provide a fascinating perspective for someone new or entering the instruction of adults. Rich is also the host of the Ludicast, a podcast covering interviews with subject matter experts in Ludic pedagogy. Following him is Keith Edmonds, business professor at Brandon University. Keith is an experienced instructor with a demonstrated history of working in the higher education industry. Along with Dr. Sharon Lorisella, he is also the co-author of the book Ludic Pedagogy, a seriously fun way to teach and learn. Keith is skilled in teaching human resource management, organizational behavior, and general management topics, and his research interests include ludic pedagogy, business instruction methods, workplace sense of community, and employee engagement. I hope you enjoy this discussion on a seriously fun classroom. So Keith, if you could just start off with, can you tell me a little bit about like what ludic pedagogy is and how does it differ maybe from some of the traditional teaching methods that we might see from time to time?
Sure. Ludic pedagogy is a model of pedagogy that was established in the last couple of years during and since COVID. It's really based on four pillars: fun, play, playfulness, and positivity. Now, they're all very much interact with each other. They're hard to isolate from one another, but they all play distinct roles within the model. So fun is the intrinsic motivator. So that's the thing that gets students to want to come to class, to engage in what you're doing in class, to be part of the classroom, right? What motivates them to come and stay and be part of things. So that's fun. Play is the activity. That's the thing that you do in the classroom, whether that's an assessment, whether that's an activity, whether it's a role play, whatever it is, it's the thing that they do. The third piece is playfulness. That's the attitude. That's the thing that they, the way they face the activity, what they bring to it. Playfulness is a bit of a mishmash of concepts. It brings in a lot of different things. It brings in creativity, curiosity, sense of humor, a lot of these kinds of things. So that's the attitude piece. And the last piece is positivity, and that's the affect or the moods and emotions. So that's not necessarily the idea of being toxic positivity, like being positive in the face of all the difficult issues that you might be learning about class, because students are asked to look at a lot of difficult topics in class, whether it's genocide or sexual harassment or any of these kinds of things. So it's not facing those in a positive way. It's with enthusiasm and optimism and those kinds of ideas. So all four of those work together because you can't really have effective play without being playful. Right? And if play isn't fun, then is it really play? Right? So they all sort of work together that way. And the way it differs maybe from traditional education, and it really depends what you mean by traditional, but traditional generally means the instructor at the front of the classroom, at the chalkboard or the PowerPoint, going off, and the students are considered an empty vessel in which we're pouring our knowledge. That's not a lot of fun. I mean, when I was going to school, that's what it was, and I don't remember a lot of fun in those kinds of classrooms. So ludic pedagogy sort of flips that in and finds ways to make students enjoy the classroom and engaged. And I will say this before I stop talking, it doesn't mean simplifying the course material. It's not making it fun by making it easy. It's the idea of hard fun.
A little bit moving away from that, like we joke about the sage on the stage, right? And having that person at the front of the room and that sort of hierarchical structure where there's only sort of one voice and there's only sort of one voice that matters. So it helps move away from that concept, or how does the sort of playfulness integrate to move away from having that structure where you have an instructor at the front and students at the back? How does that work?
Well, with the idea of play, with them doing an activity, it gets the students involved and engaged with the course concepts, whatever they might be. So they're actually doing things in hopefully a fun and playful way. And the studies show that playfulness and fun help with the retention of material, help with the retention of the student in the program. It creates pro-social bonds. There's a whole wealth of positives that come with it that aren't really present in those traditional ways of teaching.
Rich, I'm going to move to you if I could. How do you incorporate something like this, play and fun and that playfulness, into education and sort of the student experience? And how do you sort of tie that into maybe some of your learning outcomes in your program?
Well, I teach in the School of Business, and one of the courses I teach is economics. So I teach microeconomics, and at times it's been called the dreadful science for a reason. And it can be very theoretical, and it can be tough to get students to wrap their heads around it. And most students are so worried about being right. So that's one of the reasons why I really, when I talk to Keith about ludic pedagogy, why I really enjoy it, because it really allows the students to relax and, you know, play around with some of the things we're talking about. So, you know, one of the things that I do, and I steal a lot of ideas, ludic ideas from a lot of people, but one of the things that's been a real hit for my students is at the start of every class, I will play a music video that connects to the topic. So one of the things that's a lot of fun is it's every class starts with a music video that I play at the front of the classroom. And as I walk around and students are coming in, they know the drill is going to be that they're going to have to apply it somehow, the lyrics of the music video to the topic we're going to talk about today. So it could be the Rolling Stones. It could be something as esoteric as Buddy West's name and the other fellers. From Newfoundland, but it all ties to the concepts that they were supposed to read before they came into class. And then we'll have a discussion, and that's how most classes kick off.
As an educator, obviously there's lots of, there is a monumental amount of prep work that goes into any class that you're going to deliver. Do you find that the prep work and the sort of pre-planning is greater with using this model, or is it just a different style of prep that you put into the effort?
Well, I think the prep work is just as big or even bigger when you do something like this. But the bottom line is it comes back to ludopedagogy. If it's fun, you're internally motivated. So, you know, one of the people that I've talked to who's a bit of a role model for me is Wayne Geerling from University of Texas at Austin. And he does a tremendous amount of time going and finding out where his students live. So he builds a lot of his lessons around TikTok videos or influencers like Olivia Dunn from LSU, and applies what they're doing to economic concepts. And the nice thing about a lot of people in the ludic pedagogy pantheon of people is they're very generous. So a lot of people, Keith himself, will give you all the information you want as long as they know that you're using it for good rather than, I guess, for evil.
Keith, you've had the experience now of teaching both at the college and the university level and instruction around that. How do you put ludic pedagogy into practice in your classrooms? Rich had a great example there with the music video to sort of engage those learners. How have you found some successes putting ludic pedagogy into practice in your classrooms?
Well, it really depends on the course that you're teaching. It really has to align with the material, with the content. For example, what Rich does in his class might not work for my classes, simply based on the content we're trying to teach. At the college, I taught a course, Organizational Behavior. And to engage students, it took a while to figure this out because there's a lot of content in organizational behavior, and it covers a lot of different topics. Conflict resolution and leadership and personality and all these kinds of things. And so what I did is I created a macro context and sort of created a case study for the entire course. And the case study was the U.S., the office, the U.S. version. And so in every class, we would talk about the concepts that we were going to look at, conflict or diversity or whatever, and then we'd watch an episode of The Office, and the students would identify and analyze the situation based on the concepts that we talked about. And as the course progressed, the topics build on each other. So by the end, they were identifying three or four or five different layers of things that were happening within this case study that we were watching. So that's one episode or one example at the college. And at the university, I teach a course in negotiations. And I'll teach a tactic or a tool for negotiating whatever, buying or selling of a car or what have you. And then the next week, once students have a chance to digest that tactic, that topic, we'll do a role play. And so I'll give them their information and I'll pair them up randomly in class so they don't know who they're going to be paired with. And then they'll go through this activity of buying or selling a car or trying to negotiate, something went wrong with the car. So how you got to negotiate with the dealership or sometimes we talk about things like diversity, right? You don't want to, assign somebody a role for a nationality that they're not because that becomes very problematic. So it's the role play is aliens. Aliens buying and selling a spaceship. So, and then here's all the cultural quirks that your character has, and here's all the cultural quirks my character has. And so then, it's trying to navigate the negotiation and the culture at the same time. So that's how I've done that in that particular course. But again, you couldn't do that in another course. You would have to find a way for that particular content.
It's going to feel a bit like a shameless plug, but I remember reading that in this book, the example of the alien, right, versus just buying the car, that sort of thing, right, and creating that fun that students maybe don't even see on the surface, but they realize after the fact that they were having fun learning a concept that's really important. So I'm going to come back to you if I could, Rich. If you could talk a little bit about how maybe ludic pedagogy and that sort of idea would cater to different learning styles. And, obviously the diversity of learners that are coming forward in our classrooms now are a wide array of backgrounds and a wide array of skill and ability. How do you think some of the ludic pedagogy model would cater towards learners that maybe have had challenges with traditional classroom methods?
Well, I think, everyone has a preferred learning style, the way they like to interact with material. But one of the things that we have to do as educators is understand that part of our role is to make sure they understand that they can learn a bunch of different ways. So I think whenever we're doing something or whenever I'm doing something and thinking about, well, how do I make it fun? Sharon, Keith's co-author in the book, said something, am I boring myself? And trying to put myself in the student's shoes and giving them something that they might relate to. And we do have a lot of diverse, not only diverse learners, but diverse cultures as well. So I try and build up a library of different, when I do case studies in economics, I try and find or build case studies that speak to people's interests. And they have an ability when they do the pre-work, they can interact with that pre-work. They can either read about it, so they'll either have an article or they'll have a paper, or they can listen to it, so there'll be a link to a podcast talking about the exact same thing that's happening in the real world, or they can watch. So I try and give all the modalities available, which, like you said earlier, is a lot of work, but it can be a lot of fun trying to find things that students would interact with and then giving them the ability to interact with it in the way that they prefer.
Almost to a certain extent, creating like a UDL style of learning where you have like that universal design where they can consume that in multimodal ways in a way, but whatever way works best for them to kind of attain that knowledge. So that's exciting. So I'm going to flip the coin now and say, as an educator, what sort of challenges have you maybe faced in adopting this model? And how might educators overcome that or find ways to adapt?
That's an interesting question, because I quite often ask that question to people that I talk to. And the number one barrier that seems to come up, and it's certainly one that I faced myself, was what if I get it wrong? Like, what if I end up with wrong sauce all over myself because I spent all this time on this thing that I thought was going to be fantastic, and then it doesn't work? And there I am. What else am I going to do for the day? And so that's maybe the biggest thing. But once you get over that and understand that your students were partners in learning, and I tell my students quite often, I mean, it's not just me. We're in this together. Quite often, some of the best ideas I get are from my students. They'll send me videos. Hey, I think this will work really well. for this topic. So I've kind of lost the thread on that question, Sean, but I think you said what's the barriers? And I think fear is just like our students, right? Fear of getting it wrong. Doing a bad job is probably the number one barrier for me anyway.
What about yourself, Keith? What are some of the challenges? Obviously, you know, no pun intended, but you've wrote the book on it in a way. What are some of the challenges maybe you've faced as an educator with the model, albeit in, you know, it works, but what are some challenges and how maybe have you adapted or sort of grown in your own thinking around it?
Well, the biggest problem that I see, and it's actually a problem I'm working on now, trying to write a paper on it, is the idea that fun is individual to the person. So I might design something that is fun to me, but Rich might find it boring or off-putting or offensive in the worst case, right? So fun is a very internalized kind of concept. So how do we create something that's fun for everybody? And that's a challenge because going back to my example of the office, I had one student after about two or three episodes came up to me after class one day and said that she couldn't stand the show. She found it vulgar. And you know, I said, well, I apologize for that. Just consider it not a sitcom and consider it a case study. And that seemed to alleviate her concerns a little bit, but I don't think that she ever found that class fun to the degree that some of the other students did.
What about if we're looking at sort of creating, and I'll start with you again there, Keith, if I could, if we're looking at creating sort of critical thinkers, problem solvers, that sort of thing, and that sort of higher level learning that we can get out of, you know, out of our students. How does ludic pedagogy help create a problem solver, a critical thinker in sort of your approach to it?
I can think of right off the top of my head two ways that it can help create those kinds of thinkers. First of all, playfulness, as I said earlier, rolls in the ideas of creativity and curiosity. So if you can get a student to be playful with the ideas in the course and work with the ideas and figure out, does this concept work in this way or does it work in that way? How do I combine it with these other concepts? You've got a student that's actually actively thinking about the course concepts, which is by any measure a win for an educator. And the other way is the idea of play, getting them to do things. And play runs a whole range of things from highly structured games and here's the specific rules and you have to do these things in this order, down to the very unstructured with do what you can with these ideas, right? And so in both of those kind of structured situations, you have students that are, again, working with the ideas to make them either fit the rules in the game or to see what else they can do with those in the play. So both play and playfulness give the students opportunities to work with those ideas and try and hopefully find new ways to use them. And that's the critical thinking.
When Rich was first sort of getting into the world of podcasting, we had many discussions and chats around my desk, and we would talk about the idea of podcasting and sort of reaching out, and I love what you've done with the Ludicast and having these educators from around North America coming in and sort of weighing in and sharing their thoughts on it. So I'm going to ask you a question now to weigh in and get your thoughts. Obviously, artificial intelligence has become a bigger and bigger sort of pervasive part of our life for better or worse. Is there a place for artificial intelligence when it comes to the ludic pedagogy principles?
Well, I'm going to say absolutely there is. Keith and I haven't, it's funny, we haven't talked a lot about AI, but I use it now in the classroom. And I guess the thing that we need to consider is in the PD sessions that I've been to about AI, most of the time is spent on how we're going to catch students. Like, we got to stop them from using it. And I think that's the wrong approach. I think the approach is, we can either teach them that they can offload or outsource their learning to AI, which means they're not learning, or we can show them how to leverage it, use it as leverage to help them learn better. So one of the things that I did this year was embedded AI in the classroom, and we didn't do music videos, but at the start of every class, they had to be on their devices with AI, and they were tasked with to get them to learn how to prompt. They were given different tasks, and it could be create a slam poem about something we talked about last class, And then, you know, we would vote on which one was the best and why, and which one had the deepest understanding of what we talked about, what the theories were last class. And then a lot of my students, some found it off-putting, like he says, you're always gonna, it's such a individual thing. And you're always going to have that where some students, it resonates with them. But that, I don't think that's any different than since school has started, since education has been around. There are some courses that I resonated with that I found really easy, right? And then there were some that it was a drag to get through. I remember falling asleep in the second half of art history class all the time, right? And it was nothing to do with the instructor. It was just that it just didn't resonate with me. So one of the things that they did is they were given prompts to develop their own scenario where they had to sell something to an AI, and then the AI would give them feedback after. And they did that on their own. And the feedback that I got was they had a lot of fun doing it. There were some frustrating parts, but it was a lot of fun. And then I had to make sure that I debriefed, because at that point, I mean, AI's gone crazy and it's going to continue to exponentially get better. But earlier on, what I told my students was, look, this is like your sales manager is a rookie sales manager that's never sold, but it's just read all the textbooks. So I had to make sure that we did talk about, you can't take everything that AI gives you for granted, because a lot of it is how you construct what you're asking it. So they seem to really enjoy that, especially the stuff at the front end. We were doing Taylor Swift songs, we were doing, you know, poetry and things like that.
How about yourself, Keith? What role does AI have in the ludic pedagogy mindset, and what role can it help benefit or bolster this ideology?
AI is just a tool, and I think, you know, you think back to when Google first came out in the internet, it was like, oh no, students are going to go on the internet and find all the answers, and they're not going to learn anything, and you don't really hear that as much anymore. And now we've got this AI panic. Oh no, students are going to use AI for everything. And yes, of course, there's one or two students every year that are blatantly using AI, and it's very obvious. But at the same time, and this might be off-putting to some of your listeners, if you're designing your assessments in such a way that students can use AI to answer those assessments, I think it's a poor assessment. For example, when I'm doing the role plays in negotiations, for example, there's no way for students to use AI because they're doing the thing in real time in front of me. There is value, I suppose, in getting students to write papers about things, but you can only read so many papers on the same topic before you're bored as an instructor. So is there another way that you can get to what you want the students to do that negate the use of AI, or at least minimize the use of AI? And then on the other hand, as Rich has said, AI is a tool that it's not going anywhere. That genie's out of the bottle. So is there a way that we can use that and allow and encourage students to use that AI to improve their learning as opposed to short-circuit it?
Yeah, I think the assessment's the key, right? You have to really think hard about what you want your students to be able to do when they get out of your course. And you can build, you can use AI within that. So you can have them critique something that AI has generated, right? Or make it better.
Right.
Or what do you like about what AI has done? What don't you like and why? Like you have to scaffold it within your course. And I think it's just like we've talked about here, it depends on what course you're teaching and where your head's at, how you're gonna use it.
And the panic around AI, I think, is largely overblown, because any instructor that's taught for more than a couple of years and knows their students will identify when AI has been used in an assignment.
Yeah, it's getting harder though.
It is getting harder.
It is getting harder because I've asked it to write in my voice, and if I give it enough background, it will write in my voice.
And that, I tell my students, it takes so much training to get to that point, you might as well just write the paper yourself.
Good point.
I'm gonna ask you there, Rich, and you talked a little bit about assessment and that sort of model in the AI version. But if you had a new educator that was just starting into the field that you're working alongside or perhaps mentoring, that sort of thing, how would you tell them to properly go about assessment and evaluation of an assignment, that sort of thing, using ludic pedagogy in your classroom without taking out the fun in it, right? Like we will, as educators in an educational institution, we will find a way to take the fun out of it, right? So how do you as an instructor tell maybe a new teacher, a new professor, a new instructor, how to evaluate without losing the fun that ludic pedagogy gives them?
I can only speak for myself, and I know that Keith will have his own views on this. But to me, in terms of the assessments that I'm doing, they still have to be able to do the same thing. The context can be a little bit different, though. There's a lot of instructors right now, they're using, for assessments, they're using Taylor Swift background material, right? And so everything is constructed, well, if Taylor Swift did this, or if her roadies worked this many hours, and this was the cost associated with it. That's the key thing about ludic pedagogy, is you can't get rid of the rigor. So in terms of assessments, I would say just, you know, start with the assessment you have and think about how you can make it more interesting to the students, make them think a little harder, even have a smile. And it's always gratifying when a student gets a question and you see them smile, right? And that's because of the way that the question's constructed. Doesn't mean, like Keith said earlier, doesn't mean it's any easier. It just means that they enjoy it more.
How about yourself, Keith? How do you keep the fun in it in an institution that is built around rigor and structure and sort of a lot of ways dry content at times? How do you keep the fun in assessment?
Well, I'll default to Sharon's tool that's in the book. And Sharon has three questions that she asks herself when she's designing not just an assessment but also a classroom activity, but it works for assessment. So number one is, will this make my students more interesting at parties? So she has
you have
a very,
to unpack that.
I was going to say, it's a very loose definition of what a party is. It could be a date, it could be, you know, Thanksgiving dinner with the extended family, it could be a group of friends, whatever. Can the student talk about the material, the content of the course, in a way that's interesting? Can they explain it to someone who's not a student in the course, that doesn't have the same background? And if they can take that course material and communicate it to somebody who's outside of that area of expertise, right, they've understood it. Right, so the assessment can be something that allows them to become more interesting at parties by explaining that material. So assessing, do they understand the material? Second question is...
would I want to do it?
Yeah, that's right. Good. Yeah. Hey, thanks. Would I want to do this? So when you're assigning or developing an assessment for a student, if put yourself in the student's shoes, would I want to do this? Whether that's a three-hour exam where you have to write an essay with no materials, or, you know, whatever, you know, or doing a podcast. Is it something that you would want to do if you were a student? And the third question is, will you hate your life as an instructor when you're marking it? So if you give a class of 40 students the same paper to write, by the time you're on the fifth paper, you're already going to hate the topic and you still have another 35 to mark. So what can you do as an instructor to make it more interesting for yourself when you're marking? And again, not getting rid of the rigor and not getting making it easier for the students, but what's interesting for you? So this could be the idea of like portfolios or giving students a choice of things to do. They could do a paper or a book review or a podcast or a mini document, whatever. Give them a choice of things to do so that when you're marking, you have a variety of things to look at and you don't hate your own life. So that's, I can't take credit for those questions. Those are Sharon's.
I got one more for you, and I really appreciate both of you taking the time for this today. But what, maybe I'll start with you, Keith. What do you see as the long-term benefit? If we are 40 years down the road and looking back at sort of the infancy of ludic pedagogy, and what do you see as, what does the classroom look like then, and has this shifted the needle on fun in higher ed?
Well, actually, my dream is that it's moved beyond higher ed. That if we can train play and playfulness and positivity into our students in higher ed, it's going to trickle out into the workforce. Because like I tell my students, life's too short to work a job you hate. So if you can find a job where that allows you that playfulness and to play with the ideas, again, not getting rid of the rigor, it's not, you know, making your job easier or making your job less important. It's about finding that fun in work so that you don't wake up in the morning going, oh, only 23 more years till retirement, right? That's no way to live your life. So by having this ludic pedagogy trickle out into the ludic workforce and ludic lifestyles where every day is is there's an element of fun and play in it. I think that would be the ultimate goal for me as a ludic pedagogue.
Rich, I'm going to ask the same question. We are going to step into the aforementioned spaceship that Keith had talked about earlier, and we're going to go 40 years into the future. What do you see as this model, and how has it evolved over that time?
Wow. 40 years in the future is a long time. I think that the tools are going to get better. We're sitting in here in one of your labs, which is fantastic. We've talked about AI. We've got all kinds of students have ability to do videos on their phones right now. And, you know, I think I'm going to approach this in a little different way. In terms of, I think the first part of your, can you go back and ask me the first part of that question?
Yeah, absolutely. We're looking 40 years into the future.
The one you asked Keith.
The one I asked Keith. What do you see as the potential long-term benefits of ludic pedagogy?
Okay. So the thing, with the minute you said that, the first person that came to my mind was someone by the name of Tim Smythe. And Tim is a high school educator in Pennsylvania. He's got a bunch of degrees. And in terms of the long-term benefits, from an instructor point of view, he was on the brink of quitting the job. He'd been in the job 10, 12 years, and all the joy had been sucked out of it, talking about all the hard work and sucking the fun out of everything. And he was just about to call it quits. And he finally said, you know what, to heck with it. I'm going to teach the way I want to teach. And he teaches, he's now written a book that was nominated for an Eisner Award. And he teaches anything he teaches with comics and graphic novels. And so when you walk into his classroom, it just looks like fun. I mean, there's comics and graphic novels everywhere. There's different stations where students will go through. They're given tasks to do. And then at the end, they all come together and they have to discuss and they do their assessments. He does the assessments on the fly as they go. And I've read the papers that these students have come up with. You know, there's no rigor lost, let me tell you. I mean, these students are engaged. He's engaged, so the enthusiasm comes through. It helps them fight through those periods of time where we all get through, right? Middle of the semester, towards the end of the semester. You don't want to be there. The students don't want to be there, right? You're just like, oh my God, let's get through this. And it changes that. So I think from a cultural perspective, like he says, as people are going out into the world, hopefully we can find something in every day. No day is going to be perfect, but let's find something we can love. Let's find something we can love about the job, and let's focus on those things, right? And I think if this continues, I think you'll find people more, I guess, more generous, a little less stressed, and maybe a little less serious about life.
That's what
I heard you. I heard you snickering over there.
Well, I thank you both for taking the time to chat about this today, and just to sort of to give some insight into what this world is all about and the opportunities that educators can take to inject some fun in their classrooms once again. So thank you both for taking the time.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for having us.